Hello, we're continuing our conversation with Derek DeKirchhoff, and we're looking at what we didn't finish last time, Don Thiel's article in Explorations Number 2 in April 1954, the essay called Here Comes Everybody. Is there a part you want to go into right off, Derek, or shall I say
yes,
something?
Yes, I think so. I'd like to get to page 70, at least on my off-print here,
yeah.
Which begins an observation, which is a quote of Joyce. And it interests me because it has to do with cognition, and we'll have to deal with a lot in this paper with the question of sort of intellectual or mental cognition and body cognition,
yes,
physical
yes.
cognition, which is very interesting.
Because I'll just supplement the essay by McLuhan that Thiel cites, Joyce, Aquinas, and the Poetic Process, plus the one on Joyce and Trivial and Quadrivial in 1953, very important quotes, statements by Marshall about the drama of cognition, his theory of how art is part of the retracing process. No one has really commented on that except Arthur Coker a little bit. So is that what you're thinking of, that
yeah.
aspect? Yeah. And Don
very
takes it literally. He does it. He works with Marshall's points there in this
mm-hmm.
essay. So, yeah, you can start with the quote from Joyce about epiphany. Is that what you mean?
Yes. Yeah. That's it. Well, it's part of epiphany. There'll be another one.
Yeah.
But first, we recognize the object in one integral thing.
Is one an integral thing.
Is one, sorry, yes.
Yeah.
Is one integral thing. Then we recognize it is an organized composite structure, a thing, in fact. Finally, when the relation of parts is exquisite, when the parts are adjusted to the special point, we recognize that it is that thing which it is, its soul, its whatness, leaps to us from the vestment of appearance. The soul of the commonest object, the structure of which is so adjusted, seems to us radiant. The object achieves its epiphany. That's right. That's the description of these moments. And well, we did talk about this before when I was talking about A Strange Solitude by the French writer we were talking about. Who was it again? Oh, you'll come back. Not to worry. I think we sort of covered that particular ground. Let's move on to another point which I have sort of underlined here.
You mean the Jacques writer? Was his first name Jacques?
No,
Jean?
No. A very pretentious French, one of the sort of the minor French intellectual terrorists.
Still alive today?
Alive today? Yes, I think so. I think he's
somebody connected to Mauss. I remember talking about Marcel
no,
Mauss.
No. Not to worry. It'll come back, and
right.
then we can come back to the it's yeah. It's
well.
It's
let me just read what Don writes to introduce this quote. The context
mm-hmm.
for it.
Okay.
The term epiphany is relevant at many levels, says Don, suggesting primarily a manifestation of the intellectual word begetting joy rather than desire.
That's what I missed.
Okay.
No, wait a minute. No, it's true. It's the whole question about joy.
Yes. Well, you
that's
might want
me.
To go to the quote before. Go back to 69.
No, I'm sorry. I just misread my own point. And what I really want is to get into that issue of joy first. It's
yeah.
so extraordinary. It's as I think I mentioned before that the fact that Joyce would consider joy as a fundamental, as opposed to simply an epiphenomenon,
yes.
is stunning. I mean, and to bring it out, very, very few people are actually connected to joy in the intellectual world or in the artistic world. They're connected to whatever, but joy is another thing altogether, and it's so strong here. So that to point this out and to describe it the way that Thiel has done is actually magnificent,
yeah.
and all art which excites in us feelings of joy is so far comic, and according as the feeling of joy is excited by whatever is substantial or accidental in human fortunes, that art is to be judged more or less excellent.
Okay, well, that's joy. Okay, this is a quote from Joyce's notebooks reflect his interest, so I guess that's Thiel. Let me just give the context. Joyce's notebooks reflect his interest in comedy, because Thiel is saying comedy is underneath tragedy. It's
yes.
not a tragic vision.
Right.
Yeah, Joyce's notebooks reflect his interest in comedy as, quote, the perfect manner of art, unquote. For even tragedy participates in the nature of comic art so far as it leads to joy, dash, the end of desire. Interesting that joy is the end of desire.
Yeah, that's another one which we can point on.
Right. So then he has the quote from Joyce, which you read, "All art which excites in us feelings of joy is so far comic and according as the feeling of joy is excited by whatever is substantial or accidental in human fortunes, that art is to be judged more or less excellent." End of Joyce's quote. Then Thiel says, "Comedy in the Joycean world is concerned solely with a glory in existence itself. The epiphany, which gives a metaphysical dimension to cloacal occurrences of everyday life, is the foundation stone. Those, quote, sudden spiritual manifestations, whether in vulgarity of speech or gesture or in a memorable phase of mind itself," unquote. The term epiphany is relevant at many levels, says Don, suggesting primarily a manifestation of the intellectual word begetting joy rather than desire. It is a literary technique that provides a means of seeing things with, quote, new eyes, unquote, permitting the artist to communicate the verity of objects by manifesting their peculiar whatness or quietas, dash, their mode of existence. And then what Derek read, the original quote, is explaining the how the whatness radiates. Then Thiel, but before that quote, Thiel says, "Juxtaposition or dislocation and overlaying, oral, visual, and verbal," that's your verbi, vocal, visual presentiment, "are the technical means of handling the epiphany, sharpening the focus of an object and placing it in a new setting. By juxtaposition of the seemingly incongruous choice, Joyce arrests the movement of the mind." Now, McLuhan's always talking about the arresting and the replay. And so that's why later, when the instant replay comes in, he says that's the most metaphysical mindfuck that humans ever created, the instant replay, because it's so important already in the process of cognition that earlier arts do, you see? So anyway,
it's true.
Yeah.
So what's interesting?
I didn't finish the whole sentence. So Thiel says, by juxtaposition of the seemingly incongruous, Joyce arrests the movement of the mind through the cloacal labyrinth of daily existence. Cloacal is like going into the dirt. Cloacal labyrinth of daily existence, raw sensory reality, is the meaning of cloacal, forcing it to focus on the ordinary and commonplace. There's your cliche. As seen with eyes, and eyes in quotes. See, it's very, you have to read this very carefully. Why is he putting eyes in quotes? The process by which the epiphany is achieved occurs in three stages, according to Joyce. Then you have the quote from that Derek read. And then Don says, "Although some critics suggest a radical shift in position from the early view of the epiphany, you know, for importance of the artist as a young man, Joyce's work is consistent right up to the point at the conclusion of the wake when HCE is addressed as, quote, how culious an epiphany." So you have your HCE in there. And then he says, "While Joyce does not mention Aristotle and Aquinas with any frequency in the wake, it's because it is a world that is, quote, Thomistically drunk," unquote, that's a quote from the wake, "and where, quote, truth is a bacchanalian revel, where not a soul is sober," and that's a quote from Hegel. Joyce maintains a metaphysical realism describing the seeking of correspondences as, quote, oh, felicitous culpability, sweet, bad says to you for an archetype. See, there's the cliched archetype process that Marshall developed. For example, Joyce applied Yeats's insight that poetry comes out of conflict with ourselves by dramatizing the conflict within the self. And that is a concise summary of Don's whole section on Yeats in his PhD. In Finnegan's Wake, Shem and Sean, the twin sons of H.C. and L.P., are ultimately the artist and his daimon. There's that whole spiritual tradition.
Yeah, I know. The problem, all of this is cool. The only thing is we're running through something where we should actually slow down and get
started. Okay, you can respond to what I...
No, it's just that there was one thing back at the very beginning, which I would like
on the previous page?
Yeah, on the previous page.
The desire of the word?
No. It's I'll get it. When he says, yes, that whether to in vulgarity of speech or gesture or in a memorable phase of mind itself, I'm interested because while I do have the experience of the memorable phase of mind and I've had enough of it for it to become semi-obsessive, I have not found vulgarity helpful at all.
It's not helpful.
No. So I was interested in finding out why would Joyce ground an epiphany? I mean, an epiphany, Okay, yeah, vulgarity hits you as, oh my God, that's up, but it's really obscene. Vulgarity is, I mean, I don't see how you can confuse obscenity and epiphany. But anyway.
Well, let me attempt. Marshall said that the increase of swearing in daily life in the 20th century was due to slang, or swearing is tactile. So we retrieved tactile medieval awareness where swearing was common. And so that's vulgarity of speech and vulgarity of gesture. Rap becomes extreme vulgarity of gesture. You know, up yours gestures all through rap, you know, since the early 90s. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
So it means more than visual space. You've got many epiphanies in your Cartesian mind, but you got to include the other senses for the other forms of epiphanies. Or of,
For example, there's another point which points to this right away. Where is it now? I call it mirror neurons. It's page 73, and
okay.
He says there. He quotes. That's not. He quotes Sir Joyce, but it is Don that's writing. If language is rooted in gesture, it is obvious that the rhythm of language is closely connected with the body and its internal communication systems. Significant gestures arouse analogous patterns in both speaker and receiver owing to their co-presence in a common social or physical milieu. Now, if you know anything about mirror neurons and all the theory about the fact that whatever gesture we see, we imitate in order to understand it, and I think this is a very ground kind of observation, then I don't ignore the body at all, and I'm not just Cartesian. In fact, if anything, I've written a whole lot of different approaches of critical methods on bringing the body in, understanding cinema, for example, or the theater.
What is the point about that phrase vulgarity you don't get?
No, what I didn't get is that while the kind of shock that vulgarity is going to evoke in me as a person, I'm talking here not as a theorist or as somebody who is particularly knowledgeable about mirror neurons, but I do know that they actually have that effect. Well, having that effect is an effect of understanding of the body. That's the body actually interpreting the gesture.
Right.
And if that's the case, yes, I'm fully aware of the fact that this is a parallel to what happens to the special phase of mind. But the phase of mind is a form of recognition that takes in everything. The body actually takes only itself.
That's right.
The thing.
Yeah.
The body only takes itself. And I have nothing wrong with doing that, but everything is a lot bigger than just the body.
Well, no, I missed you. When you're laughing, I don't make what did you say?
Everything is a lot bigger than just your body.
That's right. And Theo makes the important point, though, that the whole wake is about the body. This guy is sleeping. And so the extensions of the body, Marshall's theme, is already in Finnegan's Wake. Right?
No, I agree. And all of that is probably well beyond me for the moment. I had just registered my surprise because I had not put that together before, and maybe I should.
Right. Okay. I mentioned in my essay on McLuhan a quote from Catholic Humanism and the Modern Letters, a tremendous article with a lot about Finnegan's Wake, about 1954. And he says that the intellectual cognitive process to notice the world has to be similar to the world. This is what you're getting at, that to incorporate the sensory world outside of us, it already has to be known by the world, and that was Marshall's initial idea that the world was an extension of man, because man would not know, humans would not know the world, unless it was already inside themselves.
Okay, all right, but I am not pushing it that far. What I'm saying is something that I'm giving you a very simple example, and it's been studied on monkeys, and the monkeys are actually always, those poor little things are tortured just for us to find out these things. So anyway, this monkey, and any other monkey they've tried it on, and many, many times, if I pull a banana and put my hand forward, there is a specific series of synaptic connections in the monkey's brain that actually imitate that gesture. That's what it's called. They're called mirror neurons. These mirror neurons are the body interpreting what it is that whatever gesture that they see. Or whatever, just as they see as a whole interface.
Yeah, well, Marshall says that we would not be able to recognize media, the history of media, or any technologies, unless they were already knowable in the body. Is that, that's not what you're saying here?
Yes, and it's
sort of
is.
Like that.
It is, and it has been. There's a big, for me, a very big influential book. Not big. The influence is big, not the book.
Yeah.
It's called Plans and Procedures for, and it's by Erwin Galante and Carl Pribram, and I forgot who is the third or the fourth authors. But Plans and Procedures, and it's all about how whatever gesture that we want to do, we project first in our nervous system those through those. Not at that time they were not called mirror neurons, but they are neurons of, you know, gesture preparation or gesture planning. That's exactly what it's called, plans and procedures.
Right.
And it's all about how we project in our nervous system the gesture before we actually practice it. And now if you put that in the mirror neuron theory, what happened is that in order to understand a gesture, you have to project it with your mirror neurons within your body. So
you're saying you got to rehearse the action before you do it?
You've got it. That's exactly what I'm saying.
Now, what does that tell us? What's the significance of that?
It tells us that
insight?
McLuhan is absolutely correct. I mean, he's right, but it does tell us also that it is apparently a necessary way of understanding. It's a necessary way of processing information. It's not. In other words, we have to replay whatever it is that we're a witness of.
That sounds like effects precede causes. You're rehearsing before you do the cognitive act.
That's right. It is. That's a very kind of. But what I find exciting, and I never put that together before, was that this theme of McLuhan and Joyce is actually verified by science today, and it was only verified, I think, 15 years ago. Not even.
Wow.
I think less than 15 years ago,
right,
by a group. In an Italian group that are at the San Rafael Hospital in Milano, and led by Mr. Rizzolatti, Dr. Rizzolatti.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the mirror neuron theory, and it really, really is interesting. And it's sort of semi-contemporary. It's a kind of physical, biological thing, so it's not a kind of not just a theory, but it is contemporary to mimetic theory, if you've heard about that.
Yes.
So it's very interesting because I've always grounded my own stuff in the body. I always find it much more reassuring to deal that, you know, to say that the body is there, very much part and parcel of any kind of intellectual process we're dealing with.
Right.
And let
me respond to that by saying that Marshall's major agenda was that there was no discoveries going to be made that weren't already spelled out in Finnegan's Wake. That's why he said the discoveries in Finnegan's Wake, or how they're expressed, are way more important than Einstein. And that's what a true McLuhanite or someone in the school of the Trump School of Communication would always look at new stuff and do like Erica Marshall, go back, and Barry Nevitt and others, go back and see where it is already in Finnegan's Wake. That's what Marshall was asking us to do.
Yeah, and that's what this article does wonderfully.
Yeah, it prepares the ground.
It wonderfully. Oh, sure. And it, again, as it's, you know. It's
because he talks about sociology, anthropology. He relates it to all the disciplines of the 20th century and shows how Joyce is up with that and offering new versions of it, or new pattern recognitions, or new condensations and crystallizations of what other systems were discovering. And that's what blew Marshall away. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, that book did this.
It's miserable that they had a fallout, because, boy, there would be so much more if those two had continued to work together.
Yeah, it would be. They did work together. They always were in dialogue with each other through their works. You know what I mean? I mean, Don was the only one talking about Marshall's work in the Joycean world, where Don was recognized as a Joycean scholar. He was the only one relating it. And as soon as the digital world started happening in the early 90s, Don relates it to Marshall's work and Finnegan's Wake.
Yes. Immediately.
Yeah, immediately. And he became quite well known in the 90s for that.
Mm-hmm.
It brought back his academic reputation, whereas he'd been a bureaucrat in the 80s at Trent University.
Yes.
And he told me personally that he wished, in retrospect, he was telling me this about 2002, you know, 6 years before he passed on, he said, I shouldn't have gone into the power world as much as I did, Bob. I should have stayed with my academic, my Joycean studies, and I would have spelled what I did spell out in the 90s earlier, and it would have personally been more satisfying.
Well, you know what? I could have said that without hearing what you just said. I don't understand these guys going for these positions.
Yeah.
I mean, like, why would they bother? I mean, being director of the program was not an administration for me. In fact, it was far from it.
It was not a what? A missing
experience? It was not an administrative position. Was far from it. It was just having a really great time, you know.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that, you know, why would anybody? I would never become the director of the French department.
Right, right.
You know, I wouldn't dream of it. I wouldn't think of a college. Uncle, even less of the university. Do you remember the story about the mother of Marshall bursting into tears
about
him
becoming a Catholic?
He would never become a
university
president.
Yeah.
How lucky he was.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. No, that, and Marshall knew that, and he always had that attitude. What you're expressing, he. He even said to the radical students in the late 60s, you know, Bob Ray and those guys in Toronto, when they were the radicals at universities, he says, you guys will end up on committees, which is worse than hell. You know what I mean? That is your fate. You will end up on committees.
That is wonderful.
Yeah. Let me have a side thing. I think I wanted to mention this before. You look at Marshall's PhD thesis, which is the basic, main point, other than the implied media dynamics at the time of the Renaissance, is that wisdom is not just a kind of mystical knowing or quiescence. You have to have eloquence. You have to work with language. That is full-blown wisdom. And so the role model for Marshall in his PhD, he was explaining his mother, who was a very articulate elocutionist. Did you ever hear anybody say that?
No, I know. I know that. But Morris told me those. Morris gave me the whole story of how Marshall was brought up.
Yes. Morris, you're saying. Morris.
Morris McLuhan, yeah. His brother. When I did the interviews for the Ideas Program.
Right. Yes, which I have. I actually have all those interviews. You did, I don't know if you did Tom Wolfe, but all the names of that period around Marshall.
That's good. Very good. Well, I'd be glad to hear my own too, because I've lost them.
Oh, you
I always lose things.
Yeah. Well, it's your mobile, right?
No, it's because I have lobotomies. I lose my carnet. My disk drive gets fried. I mean, that's the whole thing. It's just ridiculous.
You mean you're like Marshall? The technology can't work around you?
Was Marshall like that too?
Sort of, yeah. That's what I heard.
You wouldn't the McLuhan program was just rife with that kind of problem, to mention that one only.
Yeah.
But no, it was awful. Nothing ever worked. Nothing ever worked. It was just horrifying. I'm perfectly happy I'm away from that period of time.
Yes.
I loved it. I really did love it.
Here's
but the frustration of technology was just horrifying.
Right. And I hear about those interviews. Listen to this. I can ask a question I've always had. They are the raw interviews. Somehow, I don't know if you gave them to Nelson or you gave them to someone else who got them to Nelson, but I got copies. And,
oh, wonderful.
Yeah, and that's you fabulous. Start to interview Trudeau, and it stops after 10 seconds. Did that get all censored?
No, of course not. It probably was somebody snapped it off. I don't know. I can't. That's stupid. I had half an hour with Trudeau.
Right, and when it starts, oh, good, he's got Trudeau here. This will be interesting. And then it stops. And I said, oh, somebody got to Derek. He had to erase it or something. But
God, no, I wouldn't do that. No, the program was occupied by all kinds of weird people, and it may have happened there. I don't know.
Right.
I'm looking back at this. Talk about comedy and joy.
Yes.
I mean, the joy is absolutely there, it has been. But the comedy is remembering all the absolute insanities. You could have made a comedy series on how the program ran. But anyway, how I ran the program.
Right, well, even McLuhan, I have this image in the Monday Night Seminars. Do you remember Marshall, just before the seminar would start, he's asking for George to find something, and eventually it's in Marshall's suit pocket? Do you remember that kind of scene happening all the time? George, around to look for something, and then Marshall, it's right here in the inner suit pocket.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, I can see him do it.
He wasn't an absent-minded professor, but he might create that effect. If you used to come on once, you might think he's absent-minded, but, he wasn't. I didn't see him that way. So there's more in this. I like the pairings that Don makes. Some of it comes from Marshall. But the important thing is the first pairing is the dialectic between the brain and the bloodstream. So this is on page 67, two-thirds down.
Yes.
He's talking about the charts that Joyce made for Ulysses. In the structural chart that he used in preparing Ulysses, books 9 and 10, that corresponds to the Scylla and Charybdis, and the Wandering Rock sections of the original Odyssey, are devoted to literature and mechanics, executed in dialectic and labyrinthine techniques, respectively. This combination forms the core of both books, that's Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake, for it is the interplay of brain and bloodstream, rock and water, that's Scylla and Charybdis, the labyrinth of cognition and the dialectics of opposition that creates universal movement. Time and space are treated under the microcosm cosmos of one body. Both works achieve their epiphany in the human body. In Ulysses, the climactic moment is the union of Bloom and Steve at Bloom's home. Finnegan's Wake reaches its climax as the night world dissolves with the impact of daylight on the sleepers. Then the next part. The work of art for Joyce, as the body metaphor suggests, plays its role in this structure of knowledge, providing an anthropology, a type of knowledge and insight into man and his cultural artifacts. But think of Marshall studying media, art, cultural artifacts. The tension between the position of art is dealing with artifacts, that's the center's position, things made and manipulated by man in brackets, and the romantic view of art as natural philosophy. This tension is developed by making the artist of the night world an alchemist or alchemist. Throughout the Wake run thematic references to Jonathan Swift and Lawrence Stern as extreme representatives of the timeless neoclassical synthesis achieved by Ben Jonson and Alexander Pope. What Pope did in the Dunciad was to combine, quote, the stern poise for a swift pounce. That's from Finnegan's Wake. The stern poise for a swift pounce, working on the principle that same thing revisible or laughable in nighttime may be invaulted into the heroic couplet. That's the heroic couplet of the Augustan revolution in English literature, Alexander Pope. And it says, Pope's essay on man, for example, is an attempt to provide a comic portrait of man's mind in act. This is all Marshall stuff. A dynamic map in which the contours are changing and shifting from a series of fixed points. Joyce's interest, like Alexander Pope's, is in providing dynamic models for the changes taking place within the sensibility of man in the contemporary world. That's what Marshall did with media studies. That's an exact description of media ecology there, right?
Mm-hmm. No, it's fine. So far you're sort of reading the thing, and it's good to have a readout of the text.
Of some of this, because may never look at it. We got it right here.
But I would like to get back to the issue of cognition, because
yeah.
I think it's one I've, again, found a place that's worth looking at. So we have the nature of language as a key to the labyrinth of human cognition.
No, what page are you on? Where's that?
I'm on page, but I want to just, that's the one line. Page 74, and it's like in a larger paragraph towards the end. This technique of the Wake is an attempt to merge the onslaught of a new oral tradition with the written tradition that is ultimately based on the oral tradition. In such a method, the great clue that Joyce discovered was that the nature of language was the nature of language as a key to the labyrinth of human cognition. Well, that's fundamental.
Yeah.
And it's something that I find very surprising that people haven't really picked up, whether in cognitive sciences or whether even in linguistics, that even the French, all the French intellectual theorists simply misread that.
Yes.
I mean, they didn't get it. They didn't get the ground of language into the medium that carries it.
They didn't get Finnegan's Wake.
They certainly didn't get Finnegan's Wake. And so what happens is we have a situation here where that fundamental relationship between cognition and culture is ignored. It's like most people seem to think that, you know, there is nature on one side and language to describe it. They don't realize, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
language makes nature.
Right, and that's where they make their mistake in limited assessment of McLuhan, because they didn't get this point. So they thought McLuhan was a utopian or a Catholic propagandist or something, some ridiculous categories, you know, classification.
Ridiculous categories,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then we move on to have a whole lot of, I love Meminerva, the explanation of Meminerva.
Or Minerva, we know, right?
Minerva, yeah. I don't know how to pronounce it, but I mean, I can see what the combination of memory and Minerva.
The nerves and the brain, the nerves and thought.
That's right.
Yes.
Well, it's very, very interesting, that whole analysis. At the very last part of the page 74 is the line that starts, the term detective suggests a method for retracing the labyrinth of vowel-threaded syllables. Just love the vowel-threaded syllables. The musical motif is indicative of the manner in which the wake is constructed. It's a work of Minerva, memory, the time binder, and nerves, instantaneous sensual response leading to spatial reconstruction, fused in Minerva, the figure of mental arts and wisdom. Typical of the encyclopedic method of the wake are the correlation between the two main figures, CCE and his wife, ALP. As Marshall McLuhan writes, he quotes Marshall for a minute.
Right.
HCE is a mountain, male and active. ALP is river, female and passive. But ALP equals mountain, and historically H is interfused with A, and A is both ox face and plow. First of arts and letters, so that dramatically the role of HCE and ALP are often interchangeable. So anyway, we can go on this, but I mean, I was fascinated about the whole issue of cognition, grounded, of course, in the body, and the way that
language is the body.
The language is the body.
And right. To say it's grounded in language is the same as saying it's grounded in the body, because it's not just a verbal, it's not logocentric, it's a multi-sensory in definition of language, and then
exactly.
That includes all the media.
So that was. I'm not wanting to stop on this, but I'd like to go to your thing.
Before we do that, I got a couple. Let me finish what you were saying, because the feminist or the male chauvinist should look at how Joyce dramatically flips the HC and ALP they're interchangeable. So the feminists would say, "Well, yeah, women are passive, men are active." That's the old patriarchal model. No, Joyce is aware of what's changing on electric conditions. Right? The chemical body, physical body, is not defining people anymore. And that is the cause of all the revolutions and movements and inspirations that happened from the 60s on. Because everybody can play with the chemical physical body as an art form. Right? Because they're in a new space, which they're not noticing the effects of that.
I can give you two interesting examples of artists, if you're interested on that very thing.
Yeah, yeah.
One of them is Roseanne Alucare Stone, Sandy Stone.
I've met her. Yeah.
Well, she clearly once explained to me that 20 years before, she'd spent a whole lot of money transferring from a man to become a woman.
Yes.
In other words, she had an operation. She was a real transsexual and not a trans. She was transgender or trans? No, you're transsexual.
Yeah, not a transvestite.
Not a transvestite. And so I knew her well enough to say that I've spent many times walking with her, feeling, you know, we're friends. We really are. I mean, if we met again, we'd just embrace and all that.
Yeah.
Sandy, I've always felt extremely comfortable with Sandy. I mean, I've like always felt, how would I say, there was no, I sort of took her for a woman without any kind of hesitation or problem, even though she, as she said, I shouldn't have had the operation, because all I had to do was to simply understand my body the way I wanted to.
Right. It's a case of misplaced concreteness.
It's misplaced concreteness. And did I ever tell you about her that she gave a sort of a show in Melbourne? We were in Melbourne together at some point. I think it was 95. And after a series of really good conferences and interesting things said by all, she then got on the stage and she said to people, she distributed in the crowd of about 250 people little whistles. And she said, "I'm going to show you." And she talked about all her theories and all her work of medical research and, you know, and her understanding, which is extremely scientific. I mean, she wasn't fooling around. She said, "You know, all the parts of our bodies are pretty well there because we accept that we accept to see or feel them that way. But I can take my clitoris, for example, and I can put it in the palm of my hand and rub it and feel excitement. And you're going to help me do that." And so she said, "I'm going to rub myself and gently, and then you're going to whistle, and that will accelerate my rubbing. And then we'll both, you know." And then at the end of people did it, and that within minutes she was rolling on the ground screaming orgasmic delight. She was so much fun.
Is that showing the hunter's monkey effect? Is that what she was trying to illustrate?
No. She was simply trying to say that she could, meant that the mind was capable of reconstructing the body in a very, very persuasive way, and that she could simply displace her clitoris.
I see.
To give her part, to make her part, she made her people have an orgasm with her,
wow,
which was really very intelligent on a point of view as well as a showpiece. She's like that. She's a very, very interesting woman. And I enjoyed very much that show, but I also enjoyed her conversation and her presence. It was always a very pleasurable thing. But there was no, I mean, you know what it's like? You physically feel different with a man and a woman.
Yeah.
One does. I mean, it's like the way it is. You just observe how your body reacts to the presence of a man or presence of a woman.
Yes.
It's not just, oh, yeah, she's cute.
Yeah.
No, it's more of a, it's like something. With her, although I knew she'd been a man, that didn't seem to interfere with my experience of her as a woman.
Okay,
that's
say
what
it again. She'd been a man.
She'd been
but
a man.
You felt her as a woman, is what
but
you're
But I
saying.
Felt her as a woman. Hence, she had been able to reconstruct whatever image and whatever emanation and magnetism that she projected, and she does project it. She has a lot of magnetism.
Yeah.
Was actually regendered.
That's right.
It's very interesting because it's such a complex thing. You think that, well, all right, you've done the, you know, misplaced concreteness bit, but everything else kind of, you know.
Right. Now, Marsha would say that would not be possible unless under electric conditions because it turns the older environment into an art form. That was his main point. That even all the developments in radical modernism, you know, what Pound did with the candles and Yeats did, I mean, Eliot and Lewis and Finney's Wake, McLuhan was saying, I learned from Finnegan's Wake, Joyce may not have completely intended it, that Finnegan's Wake was a knee-jerk reaction to the radio environment. That's where the aesthetes don't like Marshall. He's pointing out that all you artists and guys running around with your Gutenberg arts are just, and those changes that happened in the 20th century, are just knee-jerk reactions to the media dynamics that have come in over the 20th century. Mm. Nobody gets to that level in art theory or art analysis.
That's right.
Lyotard starts to try to, you know, whatever his name is, Lyotard, the French terrorist.
Yes,
he tries to discuss it, but he just didn't know enough McLuhan to say to calm himself down and build on McLuhan rather than try to grope around himself. But we'll do that when we get to his quotes.
No, but the knee-jerk reaction, I have something which is a twin theory to that, which is what I call the volcanic theory. Do you know about that?
No, I don't think so.
Well, it's a volcanic theory of art, that why does art terrify and horrify its first encounters with the public, or the public is terrified by...
Yeah, real art. Marshall said new real art is always ugly. That's what you mean.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly. Why is that? And then I said it's because the artist is a sensitive plaque. It's like a photoreactive type of presence in a total environment that it reflects, and the reflection of it comes into a form that is not that breaks with the tradition, which is a theory of the avant-garde.
Well, he's picking up the rhythms of the present, which is already upsetting the society.
Which is like rap music, which is a perfect example of it. But even a painter or an architect could actually produce art that had that kind of reflective power. And so that being the purpose of art then reflecting this sort of thing, it reflects it in ways that are breaking with tradition and exploding at the surface of what is a psychological crust, like the earth crust.
Yeah, the habit from the previous environment.
And something that goes through, breaks through that crust via the artist and becomes a volcanic kind of mound, of which you're living in a volcanic mound, you would know, and I'm living by it in Naples. The idea being that when the pressure is too strong, it breaks open. That's what art comes out. But as it comes out, the lava gets colder and colder and becomes institution.
Exactly. William Irwin Thompson likes to quote Weber, the routinization of charisma. You know that phrase?
Yeah, well, it's the same kind of thing, but the idea being it's volcanic. It's a volcanic theory, and I oppose it to what I call the homeopathic theory of art, which is what happens in media and the instant communication of network system, whether it's the telephone or telegraph or what we have now, which is a little more complex.
Yeah.
But the point is that the homeopathic stuff is you have a small dose of venom that hits its own in its own viral way the public that it needs and connects at its own strength, which is weak, all kinds of modifications that take different proportions.
Right.
That's what the homeopathic theory is.
Right. So listen to this. In the late 50s, Marshall did many literary reviews in the Catholic journal Renaissance, R-E-N-A-S-E-E.
Yes, I remember that.
In it, he says, one of them is, the homeopathic means used by Hollywood. He uses the phrase homeopathic.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, they've got a president. Excellent.
Yeah.
You've got a good memory. You see, this is where it's very useful to talk about these matters.
That's right. These little details. Now, here's the other point. Here's James Joyce obviously responding to the radio environment with Finnegan's Wake accurately. That is what you do, because Marshall said the voice, we're in a tactile culture, not an oral culture. The voice is the content of radio. The form of radio is the electric tactility of simultaneity that no one had ever experienced before. You know what I mean? The whole world.
Yes.
That's the important part. It's not...
Bob, just want to time out for a bit. I need a break because I'm starving. I haven't had a chance to eat. I'm terribly hungry, so what I'm going to do is go and stuff myself, and then we can go back to this if you want.
Yeah, no, listen, say you might need 10 minutes?
No, more. I want to have 20 minutes. And I want 20 minutes, and in fact, give me half an hour so that I go back to your piece, and we continue with the French guys.
Right.
I don't know. We can come back to
this?
Yeah, I think so. I think we can come back to Don later. In fact, what would be nice is to take another paper by Don. And what I would really like, and you may help me by scanning and sending it to me, the Joyce Trivium and Quadrivium. I don't know where that book is. I am nowhere close to it.
You don't have Interior Landscape.
No, I do. But you know what it is? I was rushed out of my office. Well, not really rushed. I rushed myself out of my office. And all these books are in huge, absolutely unorganized boxes, nowhere close to what Tim Leary's proud collection was like.
Right.
Just horrifying. It would take me most of half the week to just find it.
Right.
So I can't. So what I'm requesting from you is that eventually, if you can, because
yeah,
I'm away from even libraries,
yeah,
is send me
Trivium
that
or Trivium
piece.
Yeah.
Yes, and the other one too. Joyce.
Yeah, huh? Joyce Mallarmé in the Press, I think it's called.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's absolutely. I'd love to. I know I've read them before, but it was a long time, and I'd love to read them again. And we could comment those as well.
Yeah. So let me just finish.
It doesn't
this.
Matter what we comment, but it is always nice to have a little bit of preparation.
Right. So let me finish this recording with this statement. You have Joyce describing the book accurately, and so Finnegan's Wake is the appropriate book that McLuhan gave to the baby boomers who were trying to take drugs and all this stuff. Says, you don't need to take drugs. Here's his book that's spelling out all the complexities you're going to get.
Yes, that's how I remember that.
Yeah. You're going to get from all the complexities you're going to get from psychedelics. You got to deal with it. It's already happened with Finnegan's Wake. But here's the other part, is that Wyndham Lewis is the guy who spelled out in English, starting in the 20s, early 30s, the figure ground point. He recognized, intuited, and spelled out pretty good in The Art of Being Ruled that the artists were becoming knee-jerk responses to the real art, which was a new electric environment. See, that's where the interplay between Joyce and McLuhan is very important to understand, between Joyce and Lewis, to understand McLuhan's, quote, schizoid, as Don Thiel would call it. This flipping back between Lewis and Joyce, who are aesthetically very opposite, but actually, you put them together, they're Shem and Sean, how to show this discovery that art is the way you were describing it, an eruption of ugliness or newness responding to a larger media environment.
Very good. Very useful.
Yeah.
Very useful indeed.
Okay, so
I'll
stop the recording.
Call me then in about 20 minutes, half an hour.
Okay, I will. All right.
Ciao.
Bye.